In this week's episode of Messing About in Ships, we bring you The Beach and the Bulker, 9 days on a life raft, and listener questions.
Welcome aboard to a new maritime podcast, Messing About in Ships, with John Conrad from gcaptain.com, and I'm Peter Mello from Sea Fever Consulting. Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. How are you, Peter?
I'm doing excellent, thanks. This is our second episode here. First one was exciting.
Real exciting.
Yeah, it was. Got some good feedback. Got mentioned in a couple of blog posts that I saw out there, and I got some nice comments on our blog, so it's pretty exciting.
Yes, and some good reviews from fellow maritime podcasters, especially Bob of the Maritime Accident Casebook. He had some really good comments.
Great.
Hey, Peter, we had a few questions from readers about where we got the name. Can you tell them a little bit about this?
Sure can. Thanks, John. It's part of a children's story written in 1908, children's classic, The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. And there's a famous quote in that book: "There's nothing, absolutely nothing, half so much worth doing as simply messing about in boats." Well, we're a little older now and maybe a little wiser, but we still kind of enjoy messing around in boats, right? So the boats are a little bigger and a little bit more complicated, but here we are. I think that's basically the inspiration for the podcast. I did go to Wikipedia to kind of, you know, check out what, because it's been a long time since I read that, although with young children I'll probably be reading it soon again. But it says here the novel is notable for its mixture of mysticism, adventure, morality, and camaraderie. And it goes on to say, the book made Graham's fortune, enabling him to retire from his hated, though respectable and well-paid bank job and move to the country. Graham spent his time by the River Thames doing much as the animal characters do in the book, namely, in one of the famous phrases from the book, simply messing about in boats. And at the end of the podcast today, we're going to have a little bit of an excerpt from an audiobook with a quote embedded into it before we play our music. So that's basically what the inspiration is.
Yeah, it speaks to our feelings. So we both love the water, love boat ships, and everything about it.
On that note, we also have received a couple of requests about, you know, how we came about doing this together and what's basically inspired us or what motivates us to do this and why are we doing it and where are we doing this from? So you want to tell us a little bit about what your inspiration, motivation, and location?
Well, I've been interested in technology for a long time, but my real passion has been the water. I grew up on the Long Island Sound, and I grew up sailing at a young age. I always loved the water, from sailing it to fishing with my grandpa. And when it was time to pick college, I decided to go to a maritime academy, and I graduated with a license, a third mate's license, and a degree in marine transportation. And I've been sailing ships ever since. That was almost 10 years now, and I've worked my way up, and now I have my captain's license. And I sail as a first officer in the Gulf of Mexico on a exploratory drill ship. And that's part of the reason the sound quality is a little different. I work 3 weeks on the ship, and then I'm home for 3 weeks. So it's an interesting job, and I really enjoy it.
That's great. How about a plug for your alma mater? Where'd you go to school?
SUNY Maritime College in the Bronx.
Great. Great school.
So it's a real good, beautiful campus if you ever get a chance to go there. It's on a little peninsula that sticks out. It's the separation between the East River and the Long Island Sound.
Great. Yeah, and what kind of brought me here is basically I'm very interested in helping people understand how important our maritime industry has been to basically forming this country and is today. You know, people go to Walmart and they buy a pair of sneakers and they think they miraculously, mysteriously just appear there, and they don't realize that, you know, 90% of the things that they're buying in stores of that type of goods is basically come to them via a ship. So it's been something that is basically been something I'm interested in working with for a number of years here. Prior to starting my consulting business, I was the executive director of the American Sail Training Association, and I had a great platform there with Tall Ships events to educate the public about our country's maritime heritage and the importance of maritime industry today to the country. So this podcast is just another opportunity, an exciting opportunity to use these new media tools to kind of reach out to people who might not otherwise understand the importance of the maritime industry. So that's kind of my motivation. And I'm not on any ship here.
Surprising that there's a real varying degree of knowledge about the maritime industry, and some people don't even realize the commercial side. I get a lot of assumptions that I'm in the military or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And, we can bring some of these stories out to the public and get them interested.
Yeah, I look forward to that. So next thing we want to get into here, we got a few comments from readers, actually, more than listeners, on our blogs, some questions, and we thought maybe we could just take a few seconds to try to answer the questions. And the first one was on a posting. Actually, the questions come from the same reader, and he posted a couple questions on my blog, basically asking about the MV Explorer and the fact that it's been reported that she had a small hole in her hull, and she ended up sinking. And he said, you know, he basically is asking, where were the damage control teams, and you know, what happened, basically? And we did go over this last week. John, you did a great job with, you know, telling everybody what happened. But I think you saw the question. Any response to the question for King Leo?
Yeah, so what I went over last week is the fact that this ship has a double hull design. This means that it's one hull built inside another hull, meaning that when they hit the iceberg, it was only the outer hull that was damaged. And it was a small hull, but it doesn't take much to really let a large amount of water in and create a stability problem. So what they think happened, and no one's really sure, is when the iceberg punctured through the outer hull, filled the double hull, and cracks within the inner hull slowly seep into the ship. Damage control is something that is still taught and is still practiced on ships. It's not something we drill on every week like a fire drill, but it's still important. The problem with double hull designs, though, is how do you have access to that outer hull? When you walk to the side of the ship or down into one of the lower spaces, you're actually looking at the inner hull, and there's no way to get through that to access where the damage is in that outer hull. And they could have possibly, if they had found the cracks, maybe they could have filled the cracks. We'll put some links in the show notes and some damage control videos, but the captain also has to think, you know, the guys who go down and patch these cracks, that's really cold water coming at them. They're working really hard. These guys may have to get in a lifeboat anyway if they fail. And does you really want to put them through that stress before a possibly stressful lifeboat journey? Those are just some of the questions that I thought up.
Great.
We don't know the exact answer. But
yeah, it's tough to sitting on the bottom there. It's tough to get all the answers, and I'm sure there'll be an investigation. We'll probably learn more coming in the future. And then the same reader, commenter, King Leo, also had a question about the Texas Clipper, the sinking of the Texas Clipper, the intentional sinking of the Texas Clipper, which was a blog, something we both posted about. And he basically asked, the vessel on its way down kind of flipped over, I guess, and there's been speculation that there might be an attempt to right her, because I believe she's supposed to be a reef in a diving destination off the coast of Texas there. Do you know anything about this?
I know a little bit about the program, and what they're trying to do is you have the Marid Ghost Fleet. So after a ship gets through with commercial use, sometimes the military buys it and uses it for military purposes. Sometimes the ship was purposely built for the military. But when it reaches the end of its service age, they put it in what's known as the Ghost Fleet. And this is a cold storage. And it just in case of a war, if a war happens, they can go in and overhaul these older ships, and they don't have to build new ones. So some of these ships have been cold stored for so long that people are wondering, what are our options? Now, you can scrap it and turn it into recycled steel. But another option is to sink the ship and make a really nice diving destination. There are actually plans to do this right 2 miles off of my house in Morro Bay, California, and the local community is really excited, not only for the diving opportunities, but the additional tourism revenue.
Interesting.
This particular ship is the Texas Clipper. It's the Texas A&M Maritime Academy in Galveston, and the ship, they got a new ship. This is their old one, and they were planning on doing the same thing, sinking it for a diving destination. To answer the question, I don't know. I don't know why it flipped over, and I don't have answers as to what they plan on doing it. We will keep posting on our blog, and if I find out, we'll mention it in a future podcast.
Great. Well, let's move on to our stories for this week. You got the first one here, and it's a biggie. I think it was the one that kind of helped you launch your gcaptain.com. And it was the Pasha Bulka report was released. Is that right?
Yeah, sure was. Well, the Pasha Bulka was a very large oil carrier carrying coal from Australia, the port of Newcastle. And on June 7th, there were 56 ships lined up waiting to enter the port. And the forecast for the day forecasted strong gales. Well, what happened was most of the ships left the port the previous day, on that day of 7th. And later in the day, the local port authorities actually requested that all ships leave the port. A few ships did not leave. One was the Pasha Bulka. The other two that ended up being in trouble were the Sea Confidence and the Batisse. These ships decided to stay within the anchorage. They made various preparations. Pasha Bulka decided to put out two extra shots of anchor. The longer, the more anchor chain you put out, the stronger the holding capacity is in the anchorage. So that was their preparation. And the Sea Confidence decided that they're going to ballast down. So to prepare the ship for loading of the coal, they pump out all the water in the ballast tanks, and the ship actually rises high in the water. And then as they bring it into port and load the coal down, the ship's going to sink again. Well, they have to be prepared prior to loading, and they were in this lightened condition. On the 8th, there were only six, the morning of the 8th, there were only six ships remaining in the, sorry, nine ships remaining in the anchorage, and the picked up as predicted by the weather forecast. The Pasha Bulka started to drift, as did the other ships, and they decided to weigh the anchor, to pull the anchor up from the bottom and get underway. But at this point, the weather had been so severe already that they were drifting heavily. Their ballast condition really played an integral part in this. Because they were in such a light condition, the ship was high out of the water, giving a larger sail area. There was more of that ship exposed to the wind. That was one problem. The other problem was when you're in a lightened condition, your prop is closer to the waterline. It's not dug down into the water as much as if you were under heavy ballast. So questions go to whether they did enough preparation. But what basically happened is after they lifted the anchor, they went to get underway. They had trouble doing so. They finally did get underway, and the captain made a bad decision here. Right when he saw that they were going to be okay, or He thought they were going to be okay. He decided to go down and have breakfast. And by the time he came back up, either 15 to 45 minutes later, they aren't sure, it was apparent that the drift was taking them into the beach. And at that point, he decided to make a turn. The turn failed. They went broadside to the wind and were pushed up on the shores of Newcastle Beach, which is a beautiful tourism and surfing destination. So that's the basics. Peter?
Well, what happened to the vessel itself? What's her condition right now?
She was up on the beach for many months, and people came from all around Australia to come see her. There's some beautiful pictures. I'll post them on the link on the show notes of the ship sitting right up on the beach. Right after it got on the beach, the crew got helicoptered off, and then it sat there for a number of weeks while the salvage team determined the condition and made preparations to bring her off. Finally, it was pulled off the beach and towed to a nearby location and eventually released to go to a shipyard up north. I believe it was Korea, but I'm not sure.
Mm. And is she okay?
They're now getting repaired.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any substantial damage that they could find. From the report, it's obviously going to be an expensive shipyard repair, but nothing severe enough where they'd have to scrap her.
Now, what happens to the captain?
Well, that's an interesting question. And the captain was a foreign national. He was not Australian. And he was sailing under a Panama flag. So there are questions as to how much the Australians can do and how to get the captain. He was released with the ship. If they're going to bring the captain, try to get him back, extradited from the country he's in to face charges, and really what his culpability is. He did cooperate with investigators. He gave a full report. He was very helpful afterwards. So the final decision was to send a letter to Panama recommending they reevaluate his license for possible removal of his master's license. But nothing official has been done or has been recommended.
Now, was there no loss of life in this, was there?
No, there was no loss of life, no permanent environmental damage.
Wow, pretty lucky, huh?
Very lucky, very
yeah.
lucky.
Those pictures are really spectacular. I mean, you had a bunch on your blog, and I think you had a slideshow, actually. You have a slideshow on your blog, and the pictures are really quite spectacular, and we will link to that in the show notes. Anything else that comes out of this that you really want to talk about?
There are a few questions that came up. Some of it was with the timeline and where the bulker was located. Also, who has final authority to kick these vessels out of the anchorage? And the Pashabulka was anchored within state waters, but not within port limits. So the port authority could only give suggestions for the captain to leave. They didn't have the authority to actually force him to leave. There are also questions that I came up with early, wondering where the tugs were in this scenario. So if you know a storm's coming, you're going to get underway like most of the ships did. But if you can't get underway, you call an assist tug to stand by. And only one of the vessels, the Sea Confidence, called the local tugs. And it took them so long to get out there that they weren't really Sea Confidence regained steering before. They actually dropped two anchors, which is something the Pashabulka never did.
Wow.
So that's one question. And the anchor considerations is the other question. You know, why didn't the Pashabulka attempt to drop the anchor when they went broadside to the wind? And the anchor is an amazing tool. Not only can it anchor a vessel, it can also help in maneuvering. So if they dropped that anchor to just the bottom, not let out extra chain so it went on a slope, if they dropped it just the bottom, that changes the pivot point of the ship forward right up to the bow. So while we were drifting sideways, if they had dropped just that amount, the bow would have pivoted off that anchor and gone into the wind, and the engines may have been able to regain power forward. But it proved that the engines were pretty ineffective because they were so close to the waterline. When the waves hit them, the ship was pitching. So that's forward and aft motion. And in every cycle of the pitch of the ship's motion, the propellers came out of the water and were effectively useless at that point. So it really comes down to they should have been more prepared. They should have recognized the weather scenario. And when it got bad, they should have been prepared with some ballast and had someone on standby, possibly, to drop these anchors.
Wow.
The case of not being prepared enough.
Yeah, and I mean, this was no surprise storm. It was basically what we would call a hurricane here, right? I mean, it was a major, major storm that everybody had ample warning about.
Well, they all had ample warning, but that comes to the question of what weather information the captain was going. And he said in his official report that he thought that the weather was going to pass around them and that it wasn't going to be a serious problem. And that's why he made the decision to stay. And a direct quote from the report is, on June 7th, the master read the weather forecast and assessed that the center of the gale was, quote, very far, never affecting our ship. And then it goes on, nevertheless, the master ordered that two additional shackles of cable be set, but did not ballast the vessel. So, you know, the question is asked, why didn't he saw the other ships leaving? Why did he call the other captains? It's apparent that he didn't ask them why they're leaving. He didn't call any weather forecasters, any weather experts. And he didn't have any advanced weather systems. He was just getting weather facts from his Morsat satellite. Nothing advanced, nothing real time.
It does, I would never get the answers to this, but it does create some interesting questions about leadership, too, in that you wonder what the rest of the crew and the officers aboard were thinking when the captain was dining, having breakfast, in the midst of what was developing to be a pretty catastrophic set of circumstances.
Yeah, and there's a lot of talk in the forum about the master being of a different nationality than the crew and how willing they were to approach him. When he was at breakfast, the ship was obviously getting into a real bad scenario, and no one called him. You know, what kind of message does that send? Just going to breakfast. You're right, it is a leadership question. Absolutely.
Anything else to close on this one and move on to the next story?
No, I just encourage everyone to take a look at the pictures that we'll put in the show notes. They're all from local photographers in the town that were posted on Flickr, a great photo site.
And is there an actual physical, you have a PDF of the report itself, or is it on a website somewhere that we're going to be able to link to?
Yes, we will link to the actual PDF on the show notes.
Excellent. We had another story. Did you want to...
So we're talking about a ship not being prepared for the storm and really not doing the right things with a bad weather forecast. You have a story that's a little different, huh, Peter?
Yeah. The one I chose this week comes from the gcaptain.com Discover a News site, which is a fantastic – we talked about it a little bit last week, probably talked about it a lot last week. It's a fantastic site that has so much interesting information up on it. There was a story there called 9 Days – it was submitted last week, 9 Days on a Raft After Losing Keel. And it was submitted by Tim. And the story actually the link to is in sailworld.com, and that's sail-world.com. And I was able to find the original story, which is on a website called heifetz.com. We'll have all this in the show notes. And it was called Two Against the Sea. It's basically a story about a yacht delivery that turned out to be quite an adventure, to say the least. A young woman named Libby Brolodzirki brain research student at Tel Aviv University, was just celebrating her birthday last week, I guess, her 27th birthday, and just saying that just the month before, she's probably lucky to be celebrating her 27th birthday because an accomplished, experienced, avid sailor, she decided to join a friend of hers on a delivery trip from the Indian Ocean back to Israel, I believe, on a sailing vessel. The delivery was the captain of the vessel was a professional skipper from Italy. He's 34 years old, and he had sailed this route, I believe, a number of times. And actually, the two of them had sailed a number of times together. The young woman, according to the article, started sailing at 15 years old. So she's pretty experienced. She got a captain's license of some sort at 17 years old. Like, had some captain's experience. Their cruise track was basically, they left the Maldives in the Indian Ocean, southwest of Sri Lanka. They go into the Red Sea, and from there to Israel via the Suez Canal. The vessel name was Jigo 2, and it was a pretty new boat. It looks like carbon fiber, 54-foot light carbon fiber competitive racing vessel that also seemed to have some ability to cruise. It wasn't just stripped out racer, so I think their accommodations were fairly comfortable. And they left at the beginning of September. They had worked long and hard in preparing the vessel. Like, the article here says they replaced filters, checked pumps and drains, and studied the currents and winds, and they did everything, including affixing a sharp knife to the exterior of the life raft on the stern, which they make a point of bringing out later on in the story. They were going to travel, basically do a straight shot. It says, our plan was to cover 2,300 miles in one leg. And on previous voyages, the two had sailed actually 3,200 miles in one leg across the Pacific. So they had, again, some experience. One of the reasons that they were doing this long, basically continuous navigation was because their concern about stopping. The young woman was Israeli, and their concern about stopping in the Gulf of Aden, they were a little concerned with her passport. And they were also concerned about pirates in these waters, particularly the waters west of Somalia. So they just decided we're going to just do it on one fell swoop. They, again, they communicated every day with the ship's owner via satellite phone, and seemed to be well prepared for the journey. What I loved about the article, the original article, which is basically an interview with this young woman, she talked about her experience in sailing boats from the age of 15, and says from the age of 15 she went daily to Sea Scouts working on and sailing on the boats. And her quote is, you learn about such a wide range of, what can you call it, leadership and friendship and, yes, values, all of it below the surface of this thing known as sailing, which is something that I subscribe to wholeheartedly with my work and my recent past career as the executive director of the American Sail Training Association. So they got underway up September 19th, and things were going well, and they had checked their weather before they took off and while underway, and there was nothing out of the ordinary, really. It was blowing, I think, about 20 knots or so, and the vessel was certainly capable of handling the conditions. It got a little bit more severe, and they decided to alter course a little bit away from the rum line that they had initially laid out. And they notified the captain via satellite phone that they were making this course correction to the east instead of heading due north. And that kind of eased things out a bit, helped them, made this a little bit more comfortable for them to sail. But it was still fairly rough. And I guess in the middle of, I don't know exactly what night it was, but after they made that course correction, the young woman was at the helm and heard a noise, heard some kind of noise. It wasn't a big snap or anything, but it was something that kind of startled her a bit. The captain was actually below sleeping, and he came up, and I guess it was a little bit louder for him because he jumped up on deck, and they became very concerned about what the noise was, and he went below to relieve her. He's going to put on his foul weather gear, and as he goes below, and she was all strapped in, she had a harness, she was all strapped in, as he goes below, I guess it was another snap of some sort, and the boat took a list, and it ended up basically capsizing. I mean, the mast went down into the water, and the vessel went down, and they got thrown out of the vessel. And you have to read the article because it's a tremendous job relaying what actually transpired that night. But they were able to get to the life raft, and because of that knife she had put on the stern, they were able to cut the life raft's mooring line and set themselves free from the vessel. And when they did, they noticed that basically the keel had fallen off the vessel. New vessel, the keel had fallen off, and she just went over. So here they are, and they got in this life raft, and they were fairly prepared up until that point. And they got into the life raft, and the flares in the life raft really weren't great.
How long were they in the life raft?
Well, ultimately, they were in the life raft for 9 days. But when they got in there, first few days, they noticed that the food that was supposed to be in there wasn't in there, and the water that was supposed to be in there wasn't at the volume that they had anticipated would have been in the life raft. And, John, we had a discussion earlier about whether or not the article is not clear whether there was an EPIRB on the vessel or one with the life raft. You had any comments about that?
I just wanted to question them. And I'm big on that. I wrote a post that's one of the more popular ones on my blog called Electronics Grab Bag. And it seems, you know, on merchant ships, we are primarily means of escape is a lifeboat, and we check the equipment on that every month. So we have all the basic survival equipment. But how do you notify the authorities that you're in distress? And it's the EPIRB is the real technology. And it saved countless lives, and it just works by satellites and notifies authorities of your location, and they can send people. So were you able to find out if they had one?
I was not able to find that out. I didn't really see that in anything I read. You know, my assumption was that they were so well prepared with things that they probably had one aboard, but there is no mention in the article. So that's solely speculation or assumption on my part, that being so experienced.
If they had one on board, are there other possibilities why it wouldn't have gone off?
You tell me. I probably not. So it probably would have gone off if there was one aboard, I guess.
I don't know too much about the boating EPIRBs, but I know on ships you have what's called a hydrostatic release. So when the ship goes down, when it reaches 3 meters under the water, this pressure sensor shoots a razor blade at the line and releases the boat. There is also what's called the PLB, and these are EPIRBs, but for personal use. They're really small and compact, and take them hiking or boating or wherever, you're any extreme. And I just wonder if they had those. You can buy one, keep one right in the boat or on your life jacket. And, you know, REI had the sale right now going on where you can get a PLB for $400.
Wow.
It's one of the older models. Doesn't have the exact. There are two models, one that figures out your position within, like, 75 miles, and then the new models actually send your GPS position up. They have GPS. This is the older model, but even the older model, if they had one working, they should have been able to reroute some nearby ships. Because I think, did the article say that ships were nearby? They could.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess about the fourth or fifth day, a large ship actually passed very close to them, and they fired some flares off, which the ship did not see. And she's quoted here as, "I didn't know whether I was sad she didn't see us or happy she didn't run over us. She passed that close." So it is pretty remarkable that a ship at 4.5 days drifting in this raft passed so close, or the fifth day passed so close and never saw them. One of the interesting things in the article, too, is just their kind of their preparation, but also their attitude and, about what was happening. And
they had a few quotes that were really good, huh?
Yeah, I love
those.
Yeah, this one here is no. I love this one. This one captures to me. Well, I'll read it to you. "No, because although we were not spotted, the lively movement of merchant ships showed us that we had entered a shipping lane. So it was only a matter of time." And, well, that just immediately made me think of Good to Great, written by Jim Collins. And in the book, he talks a lot about Admiral Stockdale and the attitude that Admiral Stockdale, who was a POW during the Vietnam War, and how he, you know, there was this basically a realistic optimism about certain types of leaders that pull them through what would be a a debilitating or crushing experience to anybody else. And in Good to Great, Collins goes to great length of highlighting what Stockdale was able to do about keeping a perspective. And, you know, I think he's quoted as saying that, you know, the ones that the POWs who suffered the most were those that were always looking, expecting to leave by a certain date. And Stockdale always had this kind of realistic optimism about getting through it. And that's what came across to me in this article, that they were so prepared for this. They never really panicked, and they dealt with everything that came to them and always had optimism that they would ultimately get out of it. And I do highly recommend
you. They were knowledgeable, too, right? Well, go ahead.
No, I highly recommend everybody to go, and we'll have a link to the original article, and go and read it, because it's just a great article. So I just highly recommend it. She said, over the 9 days, a wetness never stopped and salt water all over my body and the constant contact with a thin rubber that floated over the waves, hot during the day, cold at night. So it was a miserable, miserable experience. The flares were damp. The famous nutritional biscuits were non-existent. We had 12 liters of water in sealed bags of 125 milliliters each. So, I mean, it's pretty miraculous that they made it through this ordeal. You had some thoughts?
I thought it really interesting that they really thought through the problem. And, you know, I do more with short-term emergencies, fires. I'm in charge of the firefighting capabilities on my ship. And, you know, the initial abandoned ship, it seems like the people who really get through these are the ones who stay calm. That panic is the one thing that really gets you in trouble. And they stayed calm right from when the mast broke loose. Right up until they were rescued. Not only did they stay calm, they kept their heads. They were thinking. Right?
Yeah,
that's another critical part. You think through these problems, you get to an obstacle. And I think she said, "We knew that you could survive a week without any water, and they had some, and that you could survive a month without any food." So that thinking really helped them. You have thoughts?
Yeah, it They at one point in there, because she is she is a brain researcher, but she talked in the article about having an understanding of what would happen with respect to their needs for intaking food over a period of time. And the first, I guess, 24 hours is the most difficult, and after that your body adjusts and tells itself that you're not going to get this type of energy, so you need to the body actually makes adjustments that are necessary to help sustain you over that period of time. I also like this quote in here. She's talking to the journalist about the sea state, and the journalist says, "How high were the waves?" And she answers, "About 3 meters." And the journalist says, "3 meters? And you weren't worried?" And her response was, "At sea, I'm always worried." And the journalist says, "Always worried?" And her response to that was, "At sea, you have to be worried. You cannot not be worried. The sea is always full of surprises." So again, just being very prepared for being aware, situational awareness, being prepared. Maybe worried is overstating it, because worried generally kind of implies that a little paralysis can set in. But she certainly seems to have quite the situational awareness going. And then the last paragraph of the article, I'll read it to you here. "A romantic screenplay doesn't especially interest her, but she is planning a detailed professional lecture that will focus on all the safety aspects of ocean sailing. Because Libby may be a great adventurer, but she is first and foremost a responsible sailor, and on the sea," she says, "you always have to worry. You can never know whether a surprise is lying in wait for you." So that kind of encapsulates to me the gist of the article, and again, we'll have the links in the show notes to so you can read the whole thing.
I hope she comes out to California. That would be an interesting lecture.
Yeah, definitely. Those are the two stories we're covering this week. We also have our feature, New Media Ports a Call. And, John, you had a website or a newsletter I think you wanted to tell everybody about?
Yeah. The Maritime Executive Magazine, which is a wonderful magazine. It's fairly inexpensive, $39 for the year. It's just a great magazine going over all topics of the maritime world. It's concentrated on maritime executives, hence the title, and that's who their target audience is. But what I really like about the magazine is their editor-in-chief, Joseph Keith. He's from your area. He grew up in near Boston,
mm-hmm.
and He went to Mass Maritime, and he's been a writer since. But he has both perspectives. He's been out to sea as a mariner and has worked on the corporate side of things. So his writing really reflects both sides of the industry. It's a real balanced view. And I find I have a friend who is owns a shipping company, and I have many friends who are mates or even some of the lower levels on the ship. And they all really enjoy the work. And what I wanted to point viewers to is their newsletter. You can sign up for their newsletter. It gets sent every Thursday right to your email inbox. And it's always got one article by Joe and a number, and then it lists a lot of the news stories of the week. So it's not only interesting editorial, but it's going to keep you really up to date on the news source, and it's free.
Yeah, I subscribe, and I look forward to that every week. It's got great stuff in it, and I highly recommend it, too.
How about your pick of the week?
Yeah, my pick of this week is the Furled Sails Podcast, and they characterize themselves as the world's first sailing podcast, I guess. They've been doing it for a long time, actually. We're on episode number 2. They're on episode number 118, so they've got a jump on us by a couple of years, it looks like. It's a weekly sailing podcast, and it focuses on cruising and recreational sailing, and they get some great guests on board. I just finished listening to 2 episodes with Webb Childs, who's circumnavigated the globe a number of times, and some of the stories he tells are just he's a great storyteller. And I haven't listened to it yet, but Jimmy Cornell is the current one up on episode 118. I look forward to listening to that. Then my experience in the past has been, I first got into listening to them because they've interviewed a few of the tall ships captains that I'm familiar with. Particularly, there was a great interview with Captain Tony Arrow, who's the captain of the Spirit of South Carolina, the brand spanking new vessel that operates out of Charleston, South Carolina. And that was a good episode. So Furled Sails Podcast, it's at, and we'll have the link in the show notes, but it's the furledsails.com. So I strongly encourage you to check it out.
I can't wait to get back on land to high-speed internet so I can download a few episodes. It sounds fascinating.
There you go. Before we jump into the music, do you want to tell people a little bit of how to get in touch with us and maybe go over quickly the Discover News site and how they can quickly maybe participate in that?
Sure. So there are a number of levels of user interaction here. And the first way is you can just send us a simple email. And our email address is podcast@messingaboutinships.com. So just send us a normal podcast. You can also go to our website, messingaboutinships.com, and write a comment below our show notes. Or if you have a story that you would really like to be featured, go to our Maritime News Discover. And that can be found on gcaptain.com. There's a big button there. You click on that, you see our top stories for the week, and then there's a submit button up top. You click there, you put in the web address of the story that you like, you hit submit, and then other readers at GCaptain community go and vote on stories. And we pick from the top stories of the week for this podcast. So not only go and submit stories, but go show us your interest. If you go to the website and you vote on the stories that interest you, they will be featured here.
Great.
So that's the basics.
Yeah, and you could also, if you send us an email and you want to attach an audio comment to it, we'll try to figure out a way to integrate it into the show, too, so you could hear your own voice and not hear just ours. We highly encourage you to give that a shot. So this week...
Everyone's welcome.
Yeah. So this week, we're doing something a little bit different with the music. We're going to have... The first 2 minutes of it is just an excerpt from Messing About in Boats, the 1908 classic we talked about, The Wind in the Willows classic. The quote is going to be incorporated into this little audio clip and for your enjoyment. And then followed by that is a song, in keeping with the animal theme, a song called Seahorse by Jonathan Coulton, who is, this music came off the Podsafe Music Network, and he is a musician who strongly supports or encourages Creative Commons use of his work. So anyway, hope you enjoy it, and we look forward to visiting with you next week.
Do you know? I've never been in a boat before in all my life.
What? Cried the rat, open mouth. Never been in a... You never? Well, what have you been doing then?
Is it so nice as all that? Asked the mole shyly, though he was quite prepared to believe it, as he leant back in his seat and surveyed the cushions, the oars, the rowlocks, and all the fascinating fittings, and felt the boat sway lightly under him.
Nice? It's the only thing, said the water rat solemnly, as he leant forward for a stroke. Believe me, my young friend, there is nothing, absolute nothing, half so much worth as simply messing about in boats. Simply messing, he went on dreamily, messing about in boats. Messing...
Look out, rat! Cried the mole suddenly. It was too late. The boat struck the bank full tilt.
The dreamer, the joyous oarsman, lay on his back at the bottom of the boat, his heels in the air. About in boats, or with boats, the rat went on composedly, picking himself up with a pleasant laugh. In or out of 'em, it doesn't matter. Nothing seems really to matter. That's the charm of it. Whether you get away, or whether you don't. Whether you arrive at your destination, or whether you reach somewhere else, or whether you never get anywhere at all. You're always busy, and you never do anything in particular. And when you've done it, there's always something else to do. And you can do it if you like, but you'd much better not.
See you.